We are dealing with a significant number of people who are tech illiterate, and it impacts every part of their life. Obviously, we're just talking about the role that it plays in your financial life. And I think about it no differently, or I should say, I take it just as seriously as I would if we were dealing with, let's say, an actual reading illiteracy challenge. Mm-hmm. And let's say you had a elder who had prescription medicine and their inability to read sort of led them to take improper doses or miss something or, you know, something like that. Like, if that were the case, we would take that very seriously. And we would put all of these systems and things in place to ensure that we keep these people safe. But we don't think about the sort of ramifications or consequences of illiteracy when it comes to money. So All of that to say, and joking aside, that's why we are covering this particular subject in this conversation. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
I'm Kirsten, and today we're talking about tech literacy and the role that it plays in our financial lives.
Yes. You know, I feel like a broken record at this point. Maybe we've just sort of reached a certain point in our podcasting journey where I feel like I've said certain things over and over again, but like I am genuinely very excited about this topic. And not because it's like an exciting topic, it's actually a pretty somber one, but I think it's one of those topics that not enough people are talking about or have connected the dots. And so I'm glad that we're actually digging into it.
Yeah, I feel like people talk about it at like an aggregate level. It reminds me of climate change and the people who were ringing the bell about climate change like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But they had very limited language to describe, you know, what we're supposed to do about it. It was just kind of like, manage your carbon footprint. And it's like, well, those are new words. I don't even know what that means.
Right.
What does that mean? And so this is very similar where it's like, how do I know if I'm illiterate? I know how to do email. I have a smartphone. I have a Netflix account. Like, Clearly, I'm not part of the problem. Or maybe I am. So it's just, I'm happy that we're kind of talking about it. To your point, it's a very big subject because tech is such a broad word. But hopefully we land at least one or two insights that make people think differently about, you know, where they sit in on the literacy spectrum.
Yeah, I call it the Facebook effect. And I'm going to go ahead and trademark that now. But
well, they're Meta, so.
Oh, okay. Well, then I can legally use the Facebook effect.
Cool.
The Meta effect. but I remember, I mean, gosh, it seems so long ago, having this conversation with people who wanted us to do these amazing things. And by we, I'm actually like going back in time when I was in a digital marketing role, and we would have these clients who would have these crazy expectations of what they would want us as the brand or the company or corporate to do. And I just remember thinking, like, we can't do that. But again, because they could do all these things on Facebook and they felt like, you know, it was just a push of a button that you should be able to do that as a marketer or as a brander or as a web person. It's like, it doesn't really work.
It's like,
that
no,
way.
Facebook stole all of the world's best engineers.
Yeah.
Like, the world's best.
I remember people so being so upset.
We cannot replicate that.
That we couldn't change like a search result on Google.
Yeah.
Because they thought it was just like a yellow pages online.
Just submit it.
Right.
Submit a form.
So now, exactly. Just submit the form. Like, you guys should know you're the big company.
Right.
So here we are 10
who's your
years
Google
later.
Guy?
Who's your Google guy? Surely you got a guy. Everyone has a guy. And I was like,
it's not how it works.
But that's what we get for saying, you know, for using examples like, oh, it's like the plumbing on the internet.
Oh,
you
know? I know. And then that's like, all right. The limitation of metaphors.
Exactly. Well, anyway, I want to dive right into it. And I hope that is the only time I veer left. I'm going to try really, really hard to stay focused because this
reader, listener, it will not be the only time he veers.
Hold me to it. Hold me to it. Okay. So I want to think back to the first time that I actually noticed this was a problem in my life. And I'm probably wrong about this, but I think the earliest memory that I have was right around this time last year. And that's not to say that I didn't realize that tech literacy wasn't a problem, but I remember the first time it like really hit home for me. And it was shortly after we moved my mom into her new place.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember trying to teach her how to use the Nest thermostat. Mm-hmm. And I know that she knew what it was because we've had one for years and she changed the temperature. She could do that part. But now that she owned one, like the pressure was on for her to figure out how to use it, to set it, to update it. And don't even get me started on like Now you can also use the app. You don't have to get out of your bed. You can turn it off. You don't have to worry about whether or not you left it on.
Learn your behavior so you don't.
We didn't even get into
it.
All of that. She just saw the big number in the middle and thought it was like touchscreen, which is a fair assumption.
It is.
But I sat there and I was like, well, it's not. There is actually, it is a button. It's like a big old button.
Yeah.
That number is just sort of the thermostat reading or the temperature that you're setting it. And then the outer rim is the dial.
Yeah, it is
actually, as I was getting, you know, as I was trying to explain it to her, I was like, okay, you know what? This is pretty confusing. It's not like, you know, the iPhone or something like that.
Yeah, so, it's like an Apple mouse compared to a Windows mouse.
Correct. Correct. And it is kind of touchscreen, but it's not. So it was actually pretty confusing. But what really stuck with me was that even after I explained it, she couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like, she would go right back to pushing the button. I was like, no, that's not a button. The button's here. And she'd go back. Now you do it. She could push the button. And it just kept, I was like stuck in like an episode of like Groundhog Day. It was so funny, but also kind of frustrating. But it also made me think back to all of the other examples that were sort of leading up to that. And she's literally always been kind of uncomfortable. And even as I say uncomfortable, I'm struggling to find words to describe it because I think we don't really have words to describe it, which is why we sort of landed on the word illiteracy. That's actually what it's called. And we don't like to call it that because the term itself is sort of frowned upon. It's almost like insulting. But that's what it's called. It's a tech illiteracy. You can call it discomfort. You can call it whatever you want. But if you don't know what some of these symbols intuitively stand for or what these words mean or any of this jargon, like you are sort of clueless and you're guessing and fumbling your way through and just, you know, you really need someone to show you or to teach you how to use products. And like, it's just kind of weird. And, you know, I land on this. I remember when we shot Money on the Table, I think it was episode 2, season 1, and we invited her over for dinner. We were just sort of unpacking her origin story and growing up in Jamaica. And one of the things that really stuck with me is that she grew up in Jamaica without electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so telling for me.
She remembers the day that the lights came on.
Yeah, she remembers that. And then it just made me think like, okay, we literally, like granted, one generation removed, but I grew up, you know, very comfortable with technology. And it was helpful for me because it made me realize that, okay, you're dealing with someone who didn't grow up with technology. And you can joke about that or be frustrated about that, but like her learning curve is significantly steeper than ours ever was.
Yeah.
And so it's it was just kind of helpful. But anyway.
Yeah, you touched on a lot. I think I'll double click on the first part, which is just the word illiteracy and why it feels so harsh to call it that, because it almost feels like an accusation, like something you've chosen not to do. And it feels like an unnatural choice because you immediately make this link to reading.
Yes.
Most people understand the value of reading. And so they choose to do it, even if it's much later in life, like, you know, it might be way later in life, you understand the value of reading and you choose to do it. But with tech illiteracy, it's not as simple as learning how to understand the alphabet and sound out words. Like there is symbolism, there is sounds, there's iconography. And so like when I'm explaining something to my mom and I'm like, click the hamburger, she's like, what does that mean?
I don't see a hamburger.
She's like, I don't see a hamburger. And I'm like, oh, you mean the three vertical lines? Like that typically translates to menu, you know? But yeah, I completely relate. I remember those moments with your mom. And it's funny because my parents are actually opposites with their tech attitudes.
Right.
My dad fully embraces and adopts technology and has for the last 20, 30 years. I'm one of the few people in my peer group that I know that had like a personal computer at home. And we had the printer where the paper was all stuck together and you had to like tear it apart and tear off the edges. Like
I remember that.
We had one of those. My dad also had one of the first car phones. And we had to call them car phones because they were not mobile or portable in any way. Like they had to be plugged into the cigarette adapter. Like it was all very dangerous. But he's just always been a gadget guy. And my mom has always had kind of one foot in and one foot out. She worked in corporate America. So she's familiar with, you know, basic Google searches, email, word processing, things like that. But if you ask her to scan a picture or convert a document or share something from the cloud, she's like, hold up now. Whoa, 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 wait a minute. And even with shopping, like she'll use her phone to look up an item, but then she will drive to the store to get it. Like that's about it. Sometimes she'll have it shipped. Target is the exception. She's very familiar with the Target app. They even got her to like adopt Drive Up. Wow. But everywhere else, she's just going to send me the link and be like, you order it. Can you order this for
yeah,
me?
Yeah, I see the picture.
Yeah.
This thing.
Your mom does that too. I get links from all the moms.
Bring one of these things home.
Yeah, make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting because, you know, to your point, it's not triple click. I'm going to open the file. I'm going to go further.
What? Drag and drop.
I'm gonna drag and drop.
Go full jargon.
I'm going to go full tech jargony. Like, I'm going to save this whole thing.
Let's just NFT
to my emotional desktop.
Oh, my God.
But no, like, there's a, you know, you were talking about reading. And I was also thinking about how virtuous the act of reading is, mm-hmm. and how being able to read or being well read is seen as
a privilege and a
sign of intelligence.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's part of the challenge here is because when we start talking about or using the word illiteracy, it's so tied to reading.
Feels like an insult.
And if anyone is sort of considered illiterate in any way, mm-hmm. there's sort of an insinuation that this person is not intelligent.
Yes.
Or is lazy thinking
or can't read. They just ignore the tech part altogether.
Correct. Correct. And so, yeah, that's part of the challenge here. But that is where we are. We are dealing with a significant number of people who are tech illiterate, and it impacts every part of their life. Obviously, mm-hmm. we're just talking about the role that it plays in your financial life. And I take it just as seriously as I would if we were dealing with, let's say, a actual reading illiteracy challenge. Mm-hmm. And let's say you had a elder who had prescription medicine and their inability to read sort of led them to take improper doses or miss something or, you know, something like that. Like if that were the case, we would take that very seriously and we would put all of these systems and things in place to ensure that we keep these people safe. But we don't think about the sort of ramifications or consequences of illiteracy when it comes to money. So all of that to say, and joking aside, that's why we are covering this particular subject in this conversation. So let's dive into it and let's see what we come up with.
So yeah, I'll just start with this. We mentioned it briefly in episode 36 when we were talking about why we were so excited about robo-advisors, but I think it's worth mentioning again because it could unlock more people feeling empowered in their relationship with tech, specifically for finance. Here's the thing. This isn't really new.
Right.
In fact, it's been a long time coming. A lot of this is the result of 2008, once banks lost consumer trust after the financial crisis, the tech companies saw an opportunity to work directly with consumers. That's what a lot of this is.
Yep.
Some of the innovation we're seeing right now is because of COVID acceleration and just, you know, companies having to pivot. But a lot of it existed behind the scenes before that. We just had this middleman in the form of a teller or a branch manager who was doing all the clickety-clack for us. But like they were using the exact same technology to open your account or deposit your check. When I think about the basics of banking, from opening a bank account or even depositing a check, all of that involves some form of tech literacy.
Yep.
I haven't been in a bank in a very long time, but the last time I was there to deposit something, it still definitely involved a keypad or a tablet. Like before, I used to just scribble on the piece of paper, slide it under the glass, and then that'd be it. She would do everything for you. But now you have to do like some verification. There's still technology even inside the bank.
Yep.
And beyond just opening accounts and paying bills online and setting up bill pay, all of that requires a baseline understanding. And so then when you move into more advanced topics like security protocols and two-factor authorization or digital wallets and sending money via Zelle, Cash App, it gets very complex, very fast.
Yeah.
And so I don't blame a lot of people from being like, nah, I'm good on that. Like,
yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's moving fast. And like, you know, you talk about the idea of people being left behind. Like that's sort of what it feels like.
It is. You know what's funny? Your mama asked me over Christmas, your mom asked me what an NFT was. And I had been preparing for this conversation for weeks. I thought it was going to happen over Thanksgiving, but I thought it was going to be my brother or my sister-in-law that would ask because, you know, it's what we, you know, I figured they would want to know, like, what y'all think about NFTs? But no, it was your mother. And she'd been dying to ask me. She'd been thinking about it for a while and just waited until it was just me and her.
I would have loved to hear some guesses. out with them.
She kept hearing about it on the news. Yeah, and right. She's like, what is it? And yeah. I just explained it to her. And she's like, oh. Psh.
Well, I'd rather her ask about what it is than ask for one.
But it was important because I'm sure in due time, somebody will try to sell her one via email or text message.
Oh, gosh. No. I can't even think about that. Right. Okay. So obviously this is a huge, huge topic. And I just want to say Kirsten is the one that veered off.
I was about
just now. And not me.
You went with me though.
But you know, I tolerated it and I accepted
anyway,
it. Anyway,
I'm not
I want
veer.
To dig into this topic because it is a pretty big one. And I want to try to focus us around a couple of key points. Y'all know me. I love a good meaty study. And I've been sitting on this study for a long time. I just hadn't really dove into it. We've incorporated some of these elements into our forthcoming book. You're going to get used to us saying that quite a bit because we're very excited about it. But I want to sort of tap into some of that right now. And so I found this study from 2018. It was published by the U.S. Department of Education, and it's entitled A Description of U.S. Adults Who Are Not Digitally Literate. We can link to this in the show notes. You can Google that as well, and you'll be able to find it, and you can open it up. I want to say it's around 30-some-odd pages, pretty easy to read. And obviously, they have tons of findings about the state of digital literacy in the United States. And so I want to ask the question, what percentage of U.S. adults do you think between the ages of 18 and 65 are digitally illiterate? I know that's a big
yeah,
range.
Yeah, that's a huge range.
Yes.
I hate ranges that are this big, 18 to 65
yes.
that are digitally illiterate.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to skew the older people to more, I would say 30% of people are digitally illiterate.
That's not bad. So that's not a bad guess. The answer is 16%.
Okay.
Yeah. So
how we define digitally illiterate.
I'm going to get to that. But 16% of people in the U.S. between the ages of 18 and 65 are considered to be digitally illiterate. I want to make sure I'm not messing that up. So roughly 1 in 6 people, 6.5, or roughly 32 million people in the United States between the ages of 18 and 65 are considered digitally illiterate. And the way that they came up with that was through an assessment. And basically, they offered up an assessment. And if you fail the assessment, or if you admitted to having no computer experience whatsoever, or if you opted out of the assessment entirely, you were sort of lumped into this category. And that's where they came up with that 16%.
Oh, that's interesting. So they gave a digital assessment, a computer assessment
yeah.
to figure out if you're digital. I can't even say that
yeah.
word.
Digitally illiterate. It's a lot of jumping up and down.
It's a lot of work. Yeah. Digitally illiterate.
Yes.
And 16% of people were just like, nah, I'm not taking it. Or
they
took it and failed, or they didn't have any computer experience to
Or they just admitted rather to saying, I have no computer experience whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So all that to say, like the majority of people in the U.S. are considered digitally illiterate, but 16% are considered to not be. And obviously there are some patterns.
The majority of people are considered digitally
literate. Yes. Yeah, I probably should slow down.
Yes.
Because I don't want people to get mixed up. But all right, let's dive in. So obviously, there are some patterns to be found with these 16% of U.S. adults. We want to see what some of those are. And some of them were that they tended to be less educated. I don't think that's that surprising. They were found to be older, which, again, not surprising. And they were more likely to be Black, Hispanic, or foreign born. I also found that the study also found that when you look at these people compared to other countries, so 16% of U.S. adults between that age group were found to be digitally illiterate. And for basically the rest of the world, that number was around 23%. So closer to like 1 in 4 adults outside of the U.S. were found to be digitally illiterate. Does any of that surprise you?
Yeah, I guess the comparison to international countries is not surprising. I think because the U.S. just has a way of ripping the Band-Aid off and
yeah.
we just like eliminate access to things if you aren't digitally literate. So
yeah.
kind of forces change versus other countries that still may, you know, accept cash or welcome
yeah.
walk-ins or have customer service people that can help you through a transaction.
Yeah.
But I also think that it trends based off of what I'm seeing. It tracks based off of what I'm seeing. based on the number of times that I see my relatives' Facebook accounts hacked because they've fallen for phishing emails and still haven't quite learned not to click things from strangers, or even just like our general political climate and the amount of fake news and how quickly articles that have extreme misinformation can spread online. It's just another indicator that people don't know how to suss out and do due diligence on the stuff that they see on the screens. But I think the bigger indicator that this is probably accurate to an extent is just our general hesitance to demand better from our institutions as Americans. So we don't even realize that better is possible. And so we still settle for things like receiving stimulus checks by mail, or this tedious tax process where we go back and forth with the government, where we give them a number that we think we owe them. And then they tell us like, yeah, I agree, or nah, I really don't agree. You actually 50-50. Owe me this. It's like, if you knew, why you didn't send it to me? Like, why are we doing this? Or even something as normalized as waiting two whole weeks to get a paycheck from an employer. Or in our case, as creatives, we'll wait 30, 60 days to receive payment from work that we've done. All of those things can be made better with a focus on fintech and financial technology that exists today. But like the depths of our literacy as a country isn't quite there yet to demand better, to demand more.
Yeah. And I would also say, you know, for the 80 some odd percent of people who are considered to be digitally literate, I'm sure there are degrees to that literacy, right? So let's, I don't want to be a downer, but let's not pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, well, then this is not a problem then, right?
And I even the sample size and the way that they've chosen to do the survey, like weeds out a good number of people that probably they just couldn't find because they're not digitally literate.
Yeah, it's a survey. It's a survey that is supposed to be representative of the sort of broader population.
Digitally literate, it's very hard to find you to take a survey.
That's true. That's true. Okay. I want to dive into it a little bit more because I would imagine that listeners are wondering, well, what are the differences between age groups, which is certainly something that I was looking at. And here's how it breaks down. So the study broke it down by 10-year increments, so 16 to 24, 25 to 34, and so on. Here's what they found. No surprise here, but 28% of people aged 55 to 65 were found to be not digitally illiterate. And so, again, if you're looking at the national average around 16%, then you could argue that almost twice as many sort of were lumped into, or half of them, I should say rather, were lumped into that 55 to 65 group. 21% of people aged 45 to 54, 14% of people aged 35 to 44, and just 11% of people aged 25 to 34. So in short, again, no big surprise there, but the older you got, the greater the likelihood that you were found to be or considered digitally illiterate.
Got it.
Yeah.
That seems right.
Yeah.
The only exception I would say is the 55 to 65 range, because I feel like if I were to line up every 55 to 65 year old that I know, I don't think that 72% of them could pass a digital sniff test, if you will. But to your point about the spectrum, could they take a survey on a computer? Probably.
Yeah, correct. And I would imagine, you know, if I'm just going to create a spectrum here, right? So it maybe starts on the low end at familiarity, you know, and then it's like, do you know what this is? Have you heard of it? And then it grows to comfort, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's ability to do something unsupervised. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them, my guess would be that, you know, towards the lower end of that spectrum, you start to see some crowding and fewer people would be very digitally savvy and able to, you know, do something that, you know, someone who is very digitally savvy would be able to do relatively quickly.
Yeah. I'm actually encouraged by the declining numbers, because if you think of a generation as 30 years, in a generation, we've got 28% of 55-year-olds who are digitally illiterate, but only 11% of 25 to 34-year-olds. And so I imagine that this will be irrelevant to measure in the next decade or two, because technology has finally entered the classrooms.
Yeah.
And so kids our son age, he's 4.5, are growing up in schools where they have access to computers, smart TVs, tablets, and more, whereas people who are 25 now may not have had that.
Yeah.
You know? And while there's still a lot to be done in terms of equitable funding and internet access in rural areas, I remain hopeful, because at least those places know what they're not getting.
Yeah.
And there are these grassroots organizations that are fighting for them. And it's not like the willful ignorance of previous generations who are underestimating what impact not having access to the right tools could do for them. These people are aware that they could be having high-speed internet. They could be having access to lesson plans and news in their classrooms, and they don't.
Yeah.
And that's encouraging for me to know that at least they're fighting for it.
Yeah. No, that's definitely good to hear. Okay. So I don't want this to become like a long readout of the study. Obviously, if you want to read it and you want to dig into it, you can do that. But there's a lot more in there. Like, we literally just scratched the surface. I want to move forward and talk a little bit more about like what the implications of digital literacy or illiteracy are for a lot of people, you know, across the United States. And I think the first problem that I think, and this may be obvious to you, but I think the first problem or like negative consequence or potential issue that we have here is around security, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a reason why hackers and fraudsters and scammers and the like target older people, because they're far more likely to not know how to identify, to your point, like what's real, what isn't, what's sort of valid. Are you a real sort of person of authority, or are you just someone that's taking or trying to take advantage of me? And this could be like from a call or a text or like a, to your point, a DM on social media that leads to someone's account being hacked. Like, all of these things can lead to some potential financial blowback. Mm-hmm. And it's a very real issue. In fact, the FBI has an entire team dedicated just to this. And they uncovered, according to their website, that about $3 billion are lost annually tied to what they call elder fraud. And it comes from all, they even like broke it down by categories. They've got romance scams.
Oh, that's a big TikTok
category. I've read about that. Or no, I've seen something on American Greed about romance scams.
But it's also like a content strategy. Like, there be people on TikTok talking about how they fell in love and there's like an 80-year age gap. And everybody in the comments is like, sis, protect your assets.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's sad. Listen, get your granny
off of TikTok.
Please. Okay. So there's romance scams. There's obviously tech support scams, which, God.
Yeah, no.
I find this stuff really interesting, but like sort of tied or connected to this is like really, really heartbreaking. But tech support scams, criminals posing as relatives, which is so real. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm your grandchild from such. Mm-hmm. Like, how many people do
and it's
you
not
know
hard to do it.
That have sent you a friend request just because you have the same last name?
Yes.
And you assume that they must be family, right?
Yes.
You've got sweepstakes, charity frauds. Like, they've got all these different categories that are all lumped up together. And on an annual basis, literally $3 billion are lost from our elders and our grandparents. And the internet is really to blame.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's such a difficult conversation to have because the solution almost feels like surveillance, even though it rarely is. It feels like we're saying that in order to protect them, we have to control them, we have to monitor them. And that's a really tough message to hear when you're already dealing with the realities of cognitive decline and decreased function.
Yeah.
But it's a reminder for us that we, the children, aren't exempt from working on our own literacy. There are startups, protections, and books that are available to us right now that can help be this second set of eyes for our aging relatives. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time to get into that today. But I do think that this is a reminder to me that we should maybe do like another episode just focused on like a caretaker toolkit.
Ooh, I like that.
You know what I mean? Just things that help you and your loved ones stay organized and mitigate the risk of elder fraud.
I like that.
I almost called it elder flog, which I don't know what that is. But anyway, I'm not going to veer. We're going to get back on the topic right after a quick break. Other implications of tech illiteracy on finances. I think it's safe to say that the discomfort or tech illiteracy will also make you less prone to adopt new platforms and investing opportunities.
100%.
Right. So we talked about robo-advisors again on episode 36, but even something as simple as opening an initial investing account, for many people, the 401k is the first investing account that you ever
only
open, or even the only, yeah, to your point, the only investment account that you ever open. But imagine if you're not traditionally employed Or if you work for someone who doesn't offer one, or maybe they make you wait until after a probation period, if you're uncomfortable with tech, you're certainly not looking at apps like Robinhood or Cash App that have a lot of perks for novice investors, like easy interfaces, mm-hmm. no minimum balance requirements, and the ability to buy fractional shares. So you're basically missing out because you're not, you know, willing to try some of these new apps.
Or able. I'm trying to add some politically correct cushioning.
It's not even politically correct. It's just true. There are some people that just aren't able to.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because I'd argue that most of the success stories that we hear in the news are from the most digitally savvy people, but it's the thing that they mention the least. And this is particularly true in the crypto space, but still relevant outside of it. Like, we always preach about index funds.
Right.
But at this point, and for those who are new to the podcast and don't know what an index fund, it's basically a bundle of stocks, right? You take a bunch of individual stocks, put them in a bundle, and you sell it as an index fund. So we talk about, like, this is the easiest way to invest, just buy a bundle. But at this point, there are over 1,400 index funds.
Right.
So if you're not digitally savvy, how do you know which indices are the most promising?
Yeah.
You certainly can't trust the first page of Google. Yeah. And if you Google the fund's of course going to tell you, like, I'm the best.
Well, two things. You may not know that you can't trust the first page of Google.
Right.
Right. You may just be assuming that, well, it's there fast. It must be legit, which I think is a fair statement. But I also think, to your point, and again, I'm trying not to veer here, but, like, even when we talk about making the jump to entrepreneurship, it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
Without having a fundamental comfort and understanding of technology, right? So when you talk about sort of the implications, what this has, right? And then when you start talking about, like, where wage growth is going, where investment is going, and where likely wealth will be built in the future, it requires a baseline level mm-hmm. of comfort or literacy with technology.
Yep.
Which leads me to another implication, or this one I'll go ahead and just call a consequence, which, you know, isn't necessarily relevant for entrepreneurs, but I think for traditionally employed people, and it's around employability, right? So when we were in the traditional workforce, we would see this all the time. And this was, I would say, like, you know, so in the earlier days of it, the early 2000s or late 2010s, and we would see, like, it sounds bad, but, like, executives sort of being turned over and sort of being replaced by younger, sharper, savvier talent, people who were able to do some of the snazzier mm-hmm. presentations. And it wasn't just because, like, they were more efficient, but a lot of it also had to do with their ability to connect with younger employees.
And right? attract employers, and attract employees from other employers.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's really scary about this is, you know, how poorly people, or I should just say employees, or just people in general, foreshadow change. I think a lot of people kind of assume that they can ride this out, right? Like, they've got enough of an understanding of all of the bells and whistles to ride this out for another 10 years. And their financial lives are essentially shaped by that. There's this underlying assumption that they are going to earn the same amount of money that they are today, if not more, for the next 10 years. And they don't really know that actually the tech landscape, or therefore the requirements of what it may, what you may need to do in order to maintain those salary levels are going to be contingent or reliant on your ability to adapt to change.
Yes.
And so if you don't do that, like, there are very real earning implications for you. And this, I'm saying this and I'm trying to be kind, but I remember working for a particular person, and I won't even say their gender. I will try my best not to do that. But I remember working for them for a certain period of time. And every time I would send an email, or really anyone would send an email, she would print it out. I already blew it.
Terrible.
It was a woman. I couldn't help it.
Just happened to be a woman.
It just happened to be a woman.
Go ahead.
Anyway, she would print out every single email. So I would go into her office. God, I feel so much better, like, not trying to code this language. But I'm talking stacks.
Yeah.
Stacks of papers. Yeah. And that's how she managed her workload and her day.
Yeah.
Like she and then when she was ready to reply, which is why she was always on the go and super busy because a lot going on. I'm like, but it does not have to be this hard. But she was, and it's not that she didn't know that she could reply, but the act of replying was very uncomfortable for her because she couldn't manage all of those conversations. She didn't know how to organize her inbox. She was just like, I'm done with it. Like,
so
I'm
not, what would she do when she would need to reply?
She would write the notes. She would write a reply or like bullet points to her reply in paper. And then she had like a color coding system.
Oh, okay.
And then she would write that on it. And then whenever she was ready, like she would like bunch them up. So if I sent her like 8 emails or something like it was last week, whenever she got around to me, she would like sort through all her papers, reply to all of the ones that she printed out, and then like come over and then we'd have a meeting, or then she'd come over to my desk or something like that.
Oh, so she walked the paper over to you.
She walked the paper. She'd give it back to me like, here's
your response.
Here's the thing that you've been looking for.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So like, God forbid you had like a response to that note,
yeah,
or didn't know how to read the handwriting or something like that. Like, yeah, it was a thing. And her expectation was that you adopt to her style. And it was like, because this is like the more thorough approach.
Well, you know, doctors like used to taking do that for notes, that sort of thing. Pre-technology.
It still happens now.
I haven't had that happen in a while because my doctor just sends the prescription to whatever pharmacy I want. But like, to your point, there are like doctors who scribble on a piece of paper and like you take it to a pharmacist and they have to like decipher.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Anyway, you're when you
long story short, she was let go.
Oh.
Right. After a while. And again, I'm not saying that to clown or joke, but yeah, it's like, you know, she was talented. She was literally in a digital marketing team, which is kind of wild in and of itself. This was 2015, right? In the digital marketing team, but like clearly uncomfortable with like the fundamentals of technology.
But that goes back to the spectrum of literacy that we talked about. There's actually a running joke about millennial adulting and this milestone of finally owning a printer, because allegedly we don't print anything and that's our problem.
Try not to.
Like, we're so annoyed when we have to print something and it's irrational. And yet it's true. Like, I bought tickets for something for Bo, for our son.
You had to print it out.
It was a kid. Yeah. I had to like bring the paper and I was just so confused about why they couldn't just scan my phone screen.
Right.
It's the same thing. But I imagine there was somebody who like defrauded them a while ago, or, you know, Janice at the ticket office prefers paper, so we still require paper.
Every time.
Like, there's always a story.
Janice.
but that leads to this broader point in general financial adulting and how much of it requires that we're comfortable using technology, all technology, printers, emails, faxes. Well, not faxes. I mean,
so, I don't know.
I've had to fax a couple of things.
I'm pretty sure
I
faxed
years.
2 people last year and they needed it. Couldn't move forward without
I know.
Crazy.
But it's even more important for us because a lot of our favorite brands and services don't have customer service departments.
At all.
So you got to know how to chat, ping, email, or tweet to get their attention. For instance, I am an avid Coinbase user. Coinbase is the app where we buy all of our cryptocurrency. And they recently expanded their services to sell NFTs. And they got a lot of new interest. Like, millions of people joined this wait list. A lot of them novices, but have heard of NFTs. And were like super excited that this app that they already have will sell them. And somebody quietly pointed out that Coinbase doesn't even have a customer service number. They've got all this interest from people in this highly unregulated space, and there's no customer service. And I was like, I never thought about that. They sure don't.
Yeah.
And for the first time, it made me take greater responsibility of my assets within their app and do things like research cold storage wallets and, you know, just take additional steps. I feel like I sound like an alarmist, but it's really wild out here for everybody, not just the elderly.
Yeah, it's
you know
the
what
wilderness.
I mean?
It's the wild, wild web internet wilderness. Like, it's crazy.
The wild, wild
web. But I'm excited.
Web.
It is.
That's the new WWW.
Yes. Wild, wild web. That's what my mom probably would guess.
All right. I know it's a lot. Sorry, y'all. I want to make sure we offer some tips. What can listeners do and what advice do you have to offer?
Yes. So I don't know how old any of our listeners are. They're, you know what? They're between the ages of 18 and 65. That's what I know for sure.
No, we probably got some 70 plus year old.
If you are 70 plus years old,
your
I need you to
listen.
Print out a transcript of this podcast and mail it to
Send
me.
Send us a note.
And I will reply back. But I think it's fair to say, I think that something I would recommend for our listeners to do is, you know, if you're engaging with someone who is uncomfortable with tech, particularly if they are older, I think there's value in meeting them where they are. And so if you're trying to just have general financial conversations with them, I know it's convenient for you to send them something that's come across your desk, your mm-hmm. literal digital desk. Mm-hmm. But there are actually websites and platforms out there that are designed for members of the older generation, right? And as crazy as it sounds, AARP is still a very relevant brand.
And a great one.
A great brand. Do not sleep on AARP. In fact, Kirsten writes for a sort of sub-column of AARP on a, I'd say, regular basis. Mm-hmm. But great brand. There's another one that I found called nextavenue.org that I think is really, really great. And so if you're looking for just like some general advice or something that you can send to people that sort of older people, especially that may resonate with them a little bit more than like something from your fancy cutting edge mm-hmm. website. Like, you know, if you really want it to stick, then sort of meet them where they are, give them something that looks and feels like them. And I think that that is a really great brand or platform. I think it's like if CBS and like Money Magazine had a baby.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Yeah, it's like catered to that generation.
Yeah. All right. My recommendation is actually related to that caretaker toolkit that I was talking about earlier, and it's the app Careful.
Yep.
Careful.
Yes.
Two L's. And Careful is just one of those apps that I think every person who is responsible or serves in the caretaker role for somebody in their family should know about. Basically, what they do is watch accounts and transactions to catch all of the small issues before they become big ones.
Yep.
And then the app helps you communicate, resolve, and plan the next steps with your loved ones. And you might be thinking, like, can I do this by myself just by logging into their accounts? And the answer is yes, but no, not the same way.
Right.
Because the secret sauce to Careful is that their proprietary technology learns what's typical, and then they can immediately spot anything that's out of the ordinary. So the more that you use it, the smarter and the more protected that you become. And then they also have money experts who are constantly researching new types of senior-specific scams and frauds and common money mistakes. And so their mission is to stay one step ahead. And because that's their full-time job, it's safe to assume that they're probably better at it than you are.
Yeah.
No
yeah,
shade.
Yeah. And I would take it a step further and I would say better at it than your primary bank. This
right.
is their sort of core reason
DNA.
For existing
exactly.
is to help people like that. We actually met with the founders last year and fell in love with the product. I think it's a fantastic product. So definitely if you're out there.
And it wasn't launched when we talked to them.
No,
like,
this was
still
pre-launch.
In beta. Like they've done a lot of additions and improvements since we last talked to them.
Yep. So if you've got like 2-3 siblings or something like that, you can all sort of join it, communicate across the board and that sort of thing. Like it's designed to sort of make this part of managing your life and the financial life of an elder easier for you and to prevent fraud. So definitely add that to your forthcoming toolkit. The second one the third one recommendation that I would say, this is more so I would say for people who are still in the workforce, and that is LinkedIn Learning. This used to be called lynda.com, but it's basically online learning. It's really, really good. Like it's a huge library of courses that, you know, I would say really relevant for anyone. But going back to what we were discussing around employability, and being able to still be competitive in the job market and not lose income. I think obviously sharpening your skills or learning new skills is really, really important, especially for people who are in the latter part of their career. And there are all types of courses on LinkedIn Learning that you can take, that elders can take at their own sort of time. They've got monthly subscriptions. I want to say it's like under $30 a month, or you can buy courses individually if you just see one that you want. But I think it's a really, really great resource. Don't sleep on LinkedIn Learning. And we can link to that in the show notes as well.
Definitely. Always good to brain train.
Brain train.
Train the brain.
There you go. All right. Final thoughts. What do you got?
All right. So I'm going to beat the drum again and just reinforce how important it is to have conversations about money with your parents or older people in your life, because they may surprise you with what they already know, like Julian's mom did me. I'm glad I was able to explain to her what an NFT was before, you know, one of her friends or some stranger offered to her to buy one. And she would have thought she was making a good decision because everything on the news, you know, communicates that these are good things and that everybody's into them.
Right.
So we talk a lot about having conversations about money with our partners, but we often forget to do that with our parents. And we kind of let respect for our elders get in the way of identifying an issue before it becomes a problem. Yes. Or even just shaping the way that they're thinking about some of the stuff that they're hearing on the news.
Yeah. You kind of stole my final thought. So I'm going to pivot and say
it again differently.
No, it's okay. You did what you did. I will say, don't be afraid. Like, going back to what you said around not letting respect for your elders get in the way, I think, especially if you have children, you know that there are all kinds of things that you want to do to make sure that your children aren't being exposed to things that are inappropriate on the internet.
Right.
Those same kinds of measures can be done on your regular browser. Don't be afraid to do that with your parents, because it's really important. And unfortunately, because financial fraud is such a delicate subject, they may be prone to not share that information with you until it's too late. They want to try to solve it themselves. And before you know it, it's gotten so deep down the hole and they don't have a choice but to share it with you. And you are likely going to be the one who are left sort of cleaning up the mess or forced to deal with it. Mm-hmm. We have heard some horror stories out there, and we don't want to scare you guys. This is really about helping keep you prepared. And again, these types of issues naturally come out of nowhere. And so this is about being proactive and making sure that we're doing everything that we can to protect not just our kids, but also our lovely, lovely elders or anyone out there who is important in our lives that is unfamiliar with technology.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you like what you heard and are feeling like testing your own tech literacy, see if you can figure out how to leave us a 5-star rating and review. We'll see y'all next week.